Hey everyone, it's Josh here from the now infamous Juggernaut with Josh segment, as Oliver would put it. No, I'm not here with any juicy Juggernaut content. I'm just here to say that Joe and Oliver are busy spending quality time with their families right now because it is the holidays and everything. But that's actually good news, though, because that means they're hard at work right now, journaling, to some extent anyway, probably, everything that happens so that they'll have good stories to tell right here on this podcast. This week, though, we're actually re-airing an episode from earlier this year with the hilarious Adam Devine. He actually just got married recently, so big congratulations goes out to Adam. And he actually talked about the upcoming wedding at the time anyway in this episode, so we figured it was good timing. Plus, it was actually good timing for me personally because I'm right in the middle of a second rewatch of Workaholics. I just can't get enough of that show. It's fantastic. Anyway, we do hope that you can manage to have a good holiday this year. I know COVID is absurd right now, so hopefully you're not completely miserable. And Joe, Oliver, myself, and Margo will all be back with a new episode of Daddy Issues next week, so we'll talk to you then. But all right, that is definitely enough out of me. Let's get into the episode right now with Adam Devine.
Oh, and there he is, right on cue.
I'm chewing, Adam. I'm chewing. I'm eating an egg sandwich, dude. You came on at the wrong time.
Oliver, can I ask, it looks like Joe is in like a super nice office with trophies and stuff behind him and pictures of his family. And that's just like you're surrounded by, is that trash or what is
it? Yeah, it's trash. That's my egg sandwich. A banana,
Advil.
Yeah,
and then I got it's just a piece of shit right now.
That's tight.
And then
that's
I have
cool.
my shoes. You see all my I have a weird shoe situation.
Well, we see what's important to you. That's nice.
And a yellow tail.
Not the family,
dude. God. You don't understand, Adam. You look. I have three kids. My house is a complete disaster and has been for about 12 years. It's just a kid's frat home. There's constant shit everywhere. You clean it up and within 5 minutes, things just appear. I can't get it right, man.
Well, I moved into a house with my now fiance, and she has done all the decorating in my home. So as you could tell, that means there's absolutely nothing on any of the walls, and none of the things that I think are important in my life are worthy of my office. So,
when did you get engaged?
I got engaged October of 2019.
So
next thing you know, there's a pandemic.
Sweet, sweet pandemic love. Uh-huh. We thought about ending it, but then we're like, well, we'll never find anyone else. So let's stick it out for 25 years, 30 years.
Yeah. Well, I got engaged. I was 29 years old. I was extremely fearful of it, right? Because I came from a family where my dad, you know, the bad divorce. Kurt came into my life as my stepfather, and that's what I saw. That's what worked, you know? Mm-hmm. So I always had this notion of, I'm not going to get married. I'm just going to be in love.
Or were you should I just bang one out real quick marriage, and then the second one will be great, the second partnership. Yeah.
Right, exactly. I didn't want to follow in those footsteps because it was not pretty for a lot of people. But my mom is the one who basically said, you know, do you love her? You know, get engaged. It's just a token. Okay. You're giving her a ring, but it's a symbol. It's saying you want to be with her for the rest of your life. You don't have to get married right away. And that's exactly what we did. I proposed and I'm like, we don't have to get married right away. So 2.5 years we were engaged and it was nice.
That's great.
It was nice because there was no pressure.
We're going to be 2 years in, and I think that's the right time for us because, you know, we were able to wrap our heads around how much bullshit you have to do for a wedding. So that's basically been, I think if we were in a year, if like we got engaged and then we got married within a year, we would get married in like an alleyway. But now we're going to do it somewhere nice with flowers and stuff. So it took us 2 years to get there.
I assume, and maybe I shouldn't. It's sexist probably, but is she hoping for the big to-do, the big wedding?
No, she actually, it's kind of, it's sort of the opposite of what you would think. She like wanted a really small, intimate, and I'm like 5,000 people, a marching band. I don't get enough attention in my work life. I also need it at home. She wanted it much smaller, and I was like, well, we got to do something. And then so we sort of compromised with the pandemic, and it's going to be much smaller than I originally wanted, but we're still going to do it at the end of this year, and hopefully some of the restrictions and some of the protocols are more chillaxed. So,
dude, I was such an asshole because I
do tell.
I'm a pretty private person, I guess, you know. I mean, when we were getting married, I didn't want anyone there who I didn't know watching me speak my vows that I had written to my wife that were mm-hmm. personal, you know, and from the heart and all, of course, all the stuff. So I made my wife, I said to Aaron, I said, look, I know you have all your girlfriends, you know, from high school and college who I kind of know and some I don't, but I really don't know who their husbands are and, or their boyfriend. They're not invited. I said, I'm sorry, but I don't want these weird dudes at my wedding. I don't know them. I don't want them sitting up with only 90 people there watching me do my shit. So we had to, tell her friends.
God,
like,
what an ass. You are an asshole.
I'm sorry.
That's hilarious. And that is also what I'm least looking forward to is being vulnerable. A word I can't say. You guys just outed me. Vulnerable. in front of all my friends and family. Because, you know, I'm used to doing comedy and I'm used to talking in front of people. But then being so open and honest with my feelings is going to be weird.
People are going to expect a joke in there. People are going to expect.
Sure.
And your mind the entire time is going to be thinking of spots where you could digress and throw some line in.
Without a doubt, won't be able to help myself. But part of me wants to be so real and so honest that it makes my dad and my uncles uncomfortable because they have the same sort of emotional response as me. that they just start booing me. They're like, boo! Yeah. Boo! Oh, back to the funny shit.
Well, I went through that. 7 years ago, almost, you know, in a few weeks, it'll be 7-year anniversary. And I wrote my vows out. My wife wrote hers out and then memorized them. I wrote mine out and read them. So she went first and delivers, you know, something from Hamlet. It was the most beautiful thing. No help whatsoever. And then I pull this stupid script out that I wrote out of my pocket. And I felt like such a dick because she went the extra mile to actually memorize what she was. And it was not short.
Wow.
I'm like, I suck. I mean, I'm already one down and we're just starting this,
I want like a cue card guy. Just standing just right behind the audience, large enough.
Right.
He's really gazing out to us. Shouldn't he be looking at us?
Are you going to write your own vows, you think, or just go standard fare?
No, cut and paste. Yeah, I'm going to find it on the internet. Yeah. no, I bet I'm going to give it the old college try.
Well, dude, because I was honestly in a crazy place when I was getting married at 29 years old. I mean, that's a whole other story. But I was just not in my right mind. I was not in my body. I was just fucking on edge for mm-hmm. various reasons. And so I for my vows, it was such a weak ass thing that I did. The way I'm describing my wedding now, it's like I'm such a horrible human being. But I took old journal entries, basically, that I had written about Aaron, and kind of just copy paste and threw them together and
read them.
Well,
that's great. You have journal entries. I don't have any journal entries. I have nothing written, so it looks like
I was a lazy man's vows, though, you know.
But did she read them journals, though? She probably didn't. She probably had never seen those before, and it still meant something to her. See? I just saved your marriage.
I just used a journal entry where I was like, not sure if this is working out between
them or not. Yeah, that was not the entry. I didn't know that you journaled. I might have to cancel this whole. I don't trust people to journal. Who's
what
got
do you
time
mean?
In the day to journal?
I don't journal every day, but I mean, there was a time when I was writing in my journal because I was just, I don't know, getting shit out.
I respect a journal because one, I don't ever, even though I definitely have time because I watched all of Peaky Blinders twice during the pandemic to journal, but it's still, I'm always like, I don't have time for that. And then anything that I've ever, even when I remotely tried to journal back in the day, I look back at those and it's cool to just sort of like jump back into where your headspace was, you know, years ago.
Well, have you ever thought about journaling about Peaky Blinders?
That's a great idea.
And that's why you're the boss, Joe. Damn it, he did it again.
Yeah.
The problem is I've gone back and read journals, and it's the same shit from 12, 15 years ago as it is today. I nothing's changed, and that is depressing because my New Year's resolutions are all the same. Everything's the same. It's like, you know, be a better guy, like be more emotional, write a script, direct something. It's all the same shit every single year that I never accomplished.
I think Adam got your journal because he's doing stuff.
I found that.
He's acting on your resolutions.
No, I actually have the exact same thing. It's funny you said that because last time I was home visiting my family, which was over a year ago now, and my mom dug out like an old notebooks that I had and gave it to my fiance to look at, which was immediately embarrassing. But they were like old. They were like sixth grade old. And it was like a note to your 20-year for 20 years from now or whatever.
That's great.
That like some sort of school assignment that I had to do. And it was get buff, make that Skrilla, I said. become a comedian and be a movie star. And then instead of writing star, I did a star, like I did a star design. And that's exactly who I am still.
and exactly what Hillary Duff wrote when she was 16 years old.
She did the same thing?
She did a star, and getting buff was something that was very important.
Yeah, super important. That's why she signed on to Million Dollar Baby. She's like, I've got to start training.
Yes.
I don't even need to read it. It's about working out.
I've got to manifest this.
But by the way, you're doing pretty good with that. I mean, are you buff? Because everything else, it seems like you're taken care of.
Have you
on
seen
the
Righteous Gemstones? Are you kidding? This kid's ripped.
Thank you, Joe. You know, I'm at a weird stage in my life where I work out every day. There's not a day that doesn't go by that I'm not out there pumping the irons. And I'm being serious about it.
Wow.
But I do work out every day. But I still – and I eat pretty well. I still drink just enough to negate all work that I do in the gym. So, and I don't drink every day. It'll be, like, one day a week. And then my one friend comes over and I drink, like, 8 beers. And then it totally negates – Well, you know, just 5 years ago, I could do that, and my body would be so on and popping. Damn, you should have seen me 5 years ago. You guys like, we did. God. It's the Pitch Perfect movie, right? You weren't that in good shape.
Dude, I need to get my body popping. It's just so fucking hard. I don't have the I just.
It's hard to have. You gotta have the time. It's not even the time because working out doesn't take that long. It's the eating. It's the eating and the drinking.
Yeah, it's the
eating. That'll bite you.
No, I know. Hey, listen to me. Okay, if you like conversations with comedic actors like in today's episode, go check out the Daddy Issues archives and listen to our conversations with actor David Spade. I've known this man for a long time. He's a great friend of mine. We discuss everything from co-parenting to comedy to hanging out in the desert to David's rise to fame and so, so much more. That's just the PG-rated stuff. Listen to this episode and you're going to hear, you know, you're going to have to cover your children's ears.
You spend your life trying not to be like your dad in some ways. And there's some things that my dad I liked, but he scrammed on us when I was four. We were 4, 6, and 8. This is where the viewership fucking dives down a little bit.
No.
This is where it spikes.
That's where it spikes.
Yeah. So just because Joe actually seems like he cares. He's a nice person.
I do. I live in Missouri. Would you like me to raise your child for you?
Oh, shit. That would be a huge help.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break with more from today's guest, Adam Devine. I don't mean to make you relive a story that I'm sure you have to always talk about, which is that accident you had when you were 11 years old, but...
Okay, we're getting... I thought this whole podcast was about journaling for a second.
Just like bullshit, and I was like, yeah. No, I get it. I mean, you're... So you grew up in Omaha.
I did.
You get hit by a truck when you're 11, which was a serious, serious accident. You have to basically retrain yourself how to walk and how to physically act in the world. And you get made fun of at school, and it brought about this tremendous wit that I think you have, this quick wit defending yourself that I think is kind of the root of the person we see today. Is that too oversimplified?
No, I think that's probably right. I mean, it's, I feel like everyone that's kind of in our positions where we talk about ourselves a lot, we have an origin story that we build up so greatly that it was like, and that's where I've gained my powers. Mm-hmm. But I think I do think there is something to it. I had a really bad accident when I was a kid, hit by a cement truck, couldn't walk for about 2 years. In and out of the hospital, I had 26 or 28 surgeries, something like that. And yeah, it was tough. And it was right when I was heading into middle school. I was going into the sixth grade. And that's when human beings are at their worst as a sixth grader. So I feel like you're kind of – usually kids are pretty sweet when they're younger. Mm-hmm. And then by the time they hit sixth grade, they're like, let's burn it all down.
Yeah. And, puberty, too, is happening.
Oh, yeah. And everyone's just so horny. And no one wants to touch the wheelchair kid. You'll get those cooties. So
were you in a wheelchair?
I was in a wheelchair for 2 years. And I was also the new kid in school. So it was kind of a double whammy.
Oh, my God. Wow.
That being said, I still had my friends. And I had people that were very kind and sweet to me. But I definitely had some people that... would make fun of me. And then later I found out that those same kids had like horrible home lives and, you know, things aren't working great, even though they're like the cool, quote unquote, cool kid at school. The rest of their life isn't that cool. So, but that didn't stop me from writing my epic slams and coming to school and totally annihilating them in front of all of their friends.
That's great.
Sorry, Brad.
have you had a moment, not to jump to the end of that, but have you had a moment where any of those kids have come back around as adults and said, hey, look, I know I wasn't nice and here's what was going on, or I'm just sorry or whatever?
Well, most of that kind of shook out through the years, just going to high school, because it didn't last forever. It was mostly middle school and then sixth and seventh grade. And by eighth grade, I played football. I was horrible at it, and my mom made me wear shin guards and arm and forearm guards like a psychopath. I was just like a marshmallow out there. But, I really tried to bounce back and just sort of assimilate and kind of do my thing. And then those same kids that ended up making fun of me, I would make fun of them back. And then once you sort of do that and realize you're not going to be a victim and you can give it as good as you're getting it, I just ended up making friends with those kids.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because we're obviously in a bully culture. I mean, not that bullying didn't exist back in the day. I think it's just there's just more awareness now. Obviously, technology has created an entirely different platform for that.
For sure.
It's extremely harmful, and kids are sometimes killing themselves because of it. But the way you combated that might be an interesting way to sort of, you know.
Well, I think it was easier too. Well, like, I don't know.
Yeah, it's like teach the kids how to fucking fight back in a way with their wit, you know.
I feel
go at them.
For at least when I was growing up before the internet, it was easy when someone would make fun of you. You could, and then everyone's watching, you could then turn around and make fun of them back. And if what you said is funnier or more clever or, you know, quicker witted than what they said, which 10 times out of 10, they were, because these kids were just first thought. They weren't putting any thought into their slams. Mm-hmm. They weren't mm-hmm. going home and writing in notebooks with mm-hmm. their legs in traction. Right. They were going about their lives. This is first thought slams that they were given. Uh-huh. And then when you would come and say that, everyone would be like, oh, never mind, this kid's cool. Now you do that on the internet and you clap back, and yeah. it's in the wash, and no one knows.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your feelings are just hurt. So it's a kind of a different thing, and I feel bad for kids that are having to go through it nowadays.
Oh, I know. I know. What about growing up? What about home life? You know, I mean, brothers, sisters.
Yeah, I have a little sister, Brittany. She's doing great now. She's mm-hmm. a fully adult woman, and mm-hmm. She did exceptionally well when I was going through my accident. It was hard for to be a little girl and you're the younger sibling, and then your older brother gets hit by this truck, and then suddenly I was just the star of the family, you mm-hmm. know, and mm-hmm. and it was like I could do no wrong. They did their best not to spoil me, but it's hard to not spoil the crippled kid because they have to do everything for you. I couldn't mm-hmm. go get myself a Capri Sun. They had to do that for me.
she did a great Capri Sun.
Who doesn't? This is sponsored by Capri Suns, isn't it?
Yeah,
we'll take anything. Yeah. We'll take anything. Sunny D, yeah. Capri Sun.
They're competitors. You can't have both. We got to pick one.
Either one. We're gonna get into a bidding war here before this thing's over.
Did that change your relationship at all? Where she's like, "Fuck this!" Basically, my brother's getting all the attention, and it's bullshit.
No, I think there was that, and I think that lasted, that came years and years later. I hired her to be a PA on Workaholics for the first few seasons. And if for your listeners that don't know, a PA is a production assistant, and that's the worst job you can have in entertainment. You're just sort of the bitch of the set, and you have to go do anything that any boss says to you, and you just... It kind of sucks, and it's my little sister, so I felt like I was almost harder on her because she is my little sister, and I didn't want to show that I'm showing any favoritism. And I remember one time I liked the ice at Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf better than I liked the ice at Starbucks. So they had like the little cube crunchy ice, and and so I would send her. Like, we would be on location somewhere, and she's like, Adam, the nearest Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf is like 8 miles away. There's a Starbucks across the street. Can I just get you Starbucks? I'm like, no, you can't. I need the. And then she finally was like, I hate this man. I'm done. I quit. And rightfully so. Looking back, at the time, I was like, well, what a spoiled little brat. And then, a few years later, I realized, oh, that was on me. Maybe I should have just allowed her to go to the regular Starbucks.
That's really funny, dude.
You have packed so much stuff. When I look at you know, your resume and the shows and, you mentioned Workaholics. I feel like that's kind of you. You have a lot of drive. You're a guy that's, I would assume, pretty tightly wound. And you don't like, if you want to lift every day, there's a reason you're lifting every day. Maybe that goes back to the accident. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe you're just getting aggression out. Maybe you just need that quiet for yourself.
Maybe he's a narcissist who just wants a really dope body to look at in the mirror.
I have so many mirrors in my garage where I work out. I have a misting cannon that missed me.
Yes. But yeah, I mean, is that you? Are you kind of the guy that's always looking for the next project?
And, you know, not to, as much as anything, anyone's life, sort of, they're all building blocks, right? So no matter what you've done in your life, you're building on top of that, and that whatever is beneath is the foundation for the rest of your life, right? So I feel my accident is the foundation for the rest of my life, for better or worse. And I think I had to go through years and years and years and years of physical therapy. So I would go 5 days a week to a physical therapist, relearning how to walk, working out every day. And that just kind of became a place and a time that I could go do my own thing and not worry about school or friends or family or anything else that's weighing on my young mind. And I can just work on myself. And I still feel that holds true today. And why I'm such just a beefy jock.
What about the mental part? What about therapy? What about your mind?
I don't do any of that, Oliver. It is a rusty steel trap up there. I feel like I'm pretty well adjusted. As anyone, I'm sure that would be helpful, but I haven't really gone down that path yet. When I do, though, I'm going to have a whole podcast dedicated to it because I do find it fascinating.
Well, that's kind of why we started this. Oliver's done a lot of work on himself. I feel like I've tried to do the same. Oliver's story with his dad is totally different than mine, and yet everybody, this through line of having daddy issues, they can be great. It doesn't have to be a tragic story or heartbreak or my dad walked out on me. It can be, you know, it's hard to live up to somebody that I admire as much as I admire my dad. Where does your dad fit on that spectrum?
Can I tell a funny story?
Sure.
That'd be funny if you guys were like, no, not here.
No. Not here. No.
Not during the daddy segment. Not during the daddy segment.
No.
we'll cut and paste it earlier. We'll put it in earlier.
I wore shorts as a kid, and I have extensive scarring on my legs from the accident. And it looks pretty crazy because not to get too gross, but when I hit the pavement, my body was going flying like 50 miles an hour on the pavement, and it ripped the skin off my knees from the knees down. And so it looks like uncooked chicken meat or like Freddy Krueger's face. And I was wearing shorts at school, and it was my senior year, and I finally was like, you know what? Screw it. I'm just going to wear shorts. And these kids were like younger kids that didn't know, were like, oh my God, what happened to your legs? Oh, what's wrong with your legs? And I'd go, my dad held me down and doused me in gasoline and would flick cigarettes at me. And they're like, oh my God. And I'm just like spinning this insane, horrible yarn for these kids. And then they went and told their school counselor, called my dad. It was like a whole thing.
Dad's
and I'm like
getting arrested, wrestled and I'm to the like, ground.
I had to go and I'm like, you know my story. I'm obviously lying to these kids. Like, you know my story. I was hit by the cement truck. I'm the cement truck kid. There's no gasoline. So my dad was pretty upset by that. But by him being a child
that'll
abuser
ruin one's
in my
wet
story.
Reputation in Omaha. It's not like you're in, you know, Manhattan. You're in Omaha.
Yeah, they'll hear about it. But no, my dad is he's pretty great. But he's super blue collar. He did not when I chose to move out to Hollywood and, you know, kind of start this path to have this career, he didn't get it, you know? I mean, he was like, he is a railroad worker and is a retired railroad worker for 35 years. So to him, like, you just get a job and start to build a life for your family. And he thought that this was the craziest thing he's ever heard. And it took a long time for him to get fully on board. But I will say, if it wasn't because of the accident, I don't think either of my parents would have been okay with moving their 18-year-old son to all the way to Southern California from Omaha, Nebraska, to, you know, live out his dreams. It seems like an insane thing. They were just sort of like, you didn't die, go for it.
Yeah, right. Right, yeah. You're destined for whatever the hell it is that you want to
yeah,
do. What was the turning point, though? I mean, you said it took a minute, but was there the moment when he was just like, oh, shit, okay, wait a minute, this is real. He's making money and he's actually, you know, supporting himself.
Yeah, that happened like last month, it was a decade in. The way he says it, he's like, even though it wasn't like I moved out here and the next day I'm starring in movies, but there was always just like little sort of stepping stones, and it seemed like I was climbing the ladder little by little. That he was like, oh, okay, he got a commercial. He like got, you know, first it was like I was getting callbacks and then producer callbacks, and then I was getting in commercials, and then I was getting little parts on shows, and I was doing stand up, and it all seemed like, I didn't just come out here and sit on my ass. So if mm-hmm. I would have done that, I think he would have, understood that, and that would have been the red flag. But I think since I came out here and sort of grinded.
But he supported you. He might not have been sort of on board because of he was just concerned, but he supported. Did he support
For sure.
you coming out and doing all of it? Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. And mostly it was my mom in his ear just going like, just he needs $600 for an acting class. I needed $400 for an acting class. I needed $200 for hot vodka.
Did you act or study it in college out in California, or was this all on the side?
No, I went to, I was going to go to UCLA, and I was accepted there, and it was just too expensive for out of state. And so I was like, I'm going to go. This was the sell to my parents that I was going to go to community college in Orange County and get transferable credits for 2 years and then transfer up to UCLA and finish college. And then after 2 years, I got three transferable credits and couldn't go to college. Like, I didn't get enough. All I took was improv class, creative writing, screenwriting. Like, right, nothing right. that would transfer to UCLA.
How about math?
Like,
how about
no, none
English,
of that. None of that.
History. Okay.
And so I then had to call them and be like, yeah, the wool was over your eyes. I'm moving to Hollywood. I'm so sorry. But they kind of saw that coming, too, so.
And that's where you met Blake, right? Isn't that that's where you met
Orange Coast Community College and met Blake Anderson and Kyle Newacek, who I ended up creating Workaholics with. And then Kyle and I moved up to Hollywood, where he went to film school, and I got a job working at the Hollywood Improv Comedy Club, answering the phones and working the door. The worst door guy they've ever had in their 40-year history. I was just like, because I was 21 at the time too, so I was just like, I understood the plight of having a fake ID, so I was like, come on in here. You're good.
Right.
You know, just the worst. Like, for sure could have got them shut down. Met them in community college, then moved up to L.A. and started to take classes at the Second City Conservatory, and then that's where I met Anders. And then that was kind of when YouTube was just starting to pop. And yeah. I got the bright idea that Kyle's in film school. Why aren't we making internet videos together? And then we just started to churn those babies out, for better or worse.
And that's where Workaholics came from.
Yeah, kind
that
of.
Was, just, that was the incubator,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. We just sort of shot a bunch of videos in the house that we lived in together. And then someone gave us office space, and they're like, yeah, you guys can use it. We like your videos. If you want to use these, you're more than welcome, these offices. And so we, like, put on ties one day and went and filmed, like, a series of YouTube videos. And the premise was we lived together and we worked together. And that's what Comedy Central saw. And they were like, this is great. You guys should do this. We thought the idea was too simple. We kept pitching. At that time, we were recording an album of us as gangster rapping wizards from another realm. With rhymes like straight out of Mordor, four more wizards come to your door. Don't sit to us because we're the motherfucking sorcerers. You know.
Standard.
Oh, my God.
We had like a full album, like I think like 15 tracks or something like that. And we were really pushing that. And we go into Comedy Central and they want to hear the Workaholics pitch. And we pitched them that. But at the end of it, we're like, but what we really want to do is... these gangster rapping wizards, and they're like, definitely not that. Please pitching us that. Stop pitching us that.
So you're kind of the. I mean, it blows me away as a 51-year-old now dad for the second time around what YouTube has become. I mean, you kind of were one of the first, at least people that I know that were doing things, putting stuff up. People were finding it. People were clicking on it. You gathered some momentum and then turned it into what you turned it into. But my God, YouTube is as big as anything out there, which I had 5 years ago. I had no idea any of that was even really there.
Yes. I still like it's changed so much since we got on it that I can't even follow it now. You know, I mean, it's like unboxing videos and kids are making like $15 million a year on wrapping toys. And I'm like, well,
it's unbelievable.
We unwrapped more toys. we didn't unwrap any toys. there's some of it I get and some of it I don't, but it was just like a platform that, truly revolutionized how you can get your content out there. I remember the first time I saw it, it was, we were editing a video, some like casting associate, like an assistant from MTV saw me do stand-up and gave me her card. And I took that back to the guys and I'm like, guys, I got an in with MTV. We have to shoot a pilot. So we shot a full-on half-hour TV show, sketch show, that we were going to present to MTV. By the way, no real connection. Just this girl who, by the time we were done shooting the pilot, no longer works at MTV, and I have no plug at MTV. But because it took us all summer to shoot and edit this thing. So we were editing this pilot, and one of the guys that Kyle had brought over to help edit the pilot was like, hey, my friends from Berkeley actually just got on SNL. They're going to be on SNL this next season. They make internet videos. And we're like, oh, really? Show us their stuff. We'll be the judge if they're funny. And it's the Lonely Island guys. It's Andy Samberg and that whole crew. And it was before they were on SNL. And they were the first people that we've ever seen a YouTube video. So they showed us in one of their old videos. And not only was the video hilarious and those guys are super funny – but also we were like, hold up, you can just press play and it'll start playing. Like YouTube was a new thing and that was the first video I saw in there. Because before then it was like you're sending QuickTime files and then it'd take 20 minutes to download or you would actually like burn a DVD and like send it to people and then obviously they're never going to watch that. So, it definitely changed the game for us.
I know. Now it's just craziness. I mean, now my kids, cause I have three kids, you know, 13, 11, and 7. And YouTube is, it's just nuts. I mean, it's just, there's so much. And then again, they watch the craziest shit that I don't understand how it's even entertaining. You know, I don't get it.
It's not aimed at you.
If you're enjoying this episode of Daddy Issues, don't keep it to yourself. Tell a friend about Daddy Issues and go subscribe on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Go tell a friend. It's like a pyramid scheme, okay?
Please.
You tell one friend.
Please.
And then those friends tell two friends.
Please.
And then four, six. It's called exponential. Exponential.
Have your daddy. Tell your daddy about Daddy Issues.
Yes. Let's go. Make this thing big. Not for us, for you.
Stay tuned. You don't want to miss the rest of our conversation with Adam Devine coming up right after the break. It's all of this is interesting to me because I feel like, and I don't want to oversimplify this, but if you go out to California and you're basically like saying to your mom and dad, mainly your dad, just go with me on this. You know, there's a drive that's put into you that I hear, you know, when you go through all that, you were doing things at this, you know, really kind of forcing your way in and not the typical like lay around guy waiting for somebody to discover them while they lay on their couch. You're out there shooting videos, putting shows together, eventually doing stand up. I mean, that to me, do you look back now as a 37-year-old and go, God, how did I
you're like, that's
do all
exhausting.
That? Yeah. Sounds horrible.
Oh my God. Every night at an open mic. Yuck. Yeah, no, I mean, I am glad I started when I was as young as I did and definitely had that drive. But I do think that I'm not special in coming up in any way, because after working at the Improv and being around comedy for as many years as I've been around it now, you really see the people that put in the work and that have that drive and that motivation to go out there every night and to always be writing, and you see those people rise to the top. And you see the people that when I was starting, I'm like, oh, that guy's so just naturally talented. He's so good. But then he's lazy as hell, and then nothing ever comes for him because nobody's looking out for you and your career.
I know those guys. So I look at that guy in the fucking mirror every day.
Oliver, no.
No. Come on. No, come back.
Oliver,
to us.
Be happy. I'm kidding. I'm not. I just
when you launch into stand-up, though, comedy can be so subjective. And if you're making your friends laugh, that's one thing. But you – that is such a leap. I know the doing the Second City stuff and doing the Improv, that helps. Mm-hmm. But to go up there alone and create and do a set of however long, you know, you don't know who's sitting out there. You don't know what their sensibilities are. And you've got to somehow make a group of strangers laugh. That's a tall task, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think it's the type of thing that if you yes, it is. It was terrifying for sure, but it kind of like gave you a little bit of a suit of armor, you know. So then when you would go and you'd bomb in front of, you know, 12 people in North Hollywood, and then you'd go into an audition room and there's 4 people there and they're judging you, and it means less when if you're just an actor and you go into a room and there's 4 people judging you. You're like, oh my God, they're judging me, and you're like, yeah, I'm used to doing this every night. So it kind of helped. I saw it immediately help in other ways, other than just because if I was only doing stand up, I might have given up sooner because it is a tough go. That first year of doing stand up, even if you are doing fairly well, which I was doing fairly well, it is a miserable existence for sure.
Yeah, see, it's funny because it was almost the opposite for Bobby Lee, who I did a TV show with. Mm-hmm. You know, he. I mean, the dude is as free as it gets. I mean, he shows his butthole on stage, which he's had to
always like, showing his butthole. Yeah,
and he's had to stop doing that. But that was his thing, you know. And everyone's seen his dick, and you know that's him. He gets our first scene on the show we did, Splitting Up Together.
Which is on ABC, by the way.
Right.
Network says butthole and show me your dick.
It truly like is America's broadcast network or channel.
He is he's so petrified, you know, and worried about doing it right and not confident that he can pull it off. And I remember having to sort of talk him off a ledge. I'm like, dude, Bobby, relax. You're great. You're funny. Just chill out.
Well, there is another side to it. I feel like a lot of comics have real deep-seated neuroses. Not speaking specifically on Bobby, but definitely Bobby.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, for sure. And that's why they get into comedy. But, yeah, I think everybody's a little different.
Yeah. What about kids?
Yeah, but Bobby is fucked up. You're right.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But Bobby, by the way, Bobby's such a great dude. I mean,
yeah, he is. He's awesome.
He is such a good human, and he's so funny and so fucking insane.
Bobby was one of the first, Bobby Lee was one of the first the first established comics that sort of wasn't just nice to me. I remember I did a set at the Laugh Factory, and he was like, "You hungry?" And we went next door, and he like bought me dinner, which was, I was just like, it's so you know, cool.
Oh, that's nice, so great.
And then he showed me his bubble. Awesome. No, yeah, he didn't.
That's what you get with dinner. That's what you get with dinner.
We didn't. We just ate matzo ball soup. kids. We actually talk about it. I feel like this quarantine has gotten Chloe a little bit of the baby fever because mm-hmm. we've just been stuck in the house and we've sort of been nesting, you know, as before the pandemic. I've never spent more than a week straight at my house. I'm always going to do something or away for a weekend or even if it's just a few days here and there. So I've never spent this much time in the house. And I think we've just been here and she's fully nested in here. And then now it's baby o'clock.
Does it scare you at all though? Does it scare you? Meaning like your work is a priority for you, right? You bust your ass. I mean, it's what you love. It's your passion. You can tell. Mm-hmm. Do you get nervous at all about what a kid will do to sort of that drive or what you might have to sacrifice for the kid? No, not at all.
No, not at all. Because I'm going to exploit them. I'm going to put them on the internet all the time.
Make money off of them, for sure.
I'm going
dude.
To maybe I hand them a Capri Sun. We get a sort of Capri Sun, Sunny Delight deal out of it. It's a bidding war. But no, I mean, truthfully, it doesn't really scare. Maybe it should scare me more than it does. I have this tendency a lot where I'm not scared of something until I'm doing it, and then I realize I should have been more scared of the thing that I'm doing, but now mm-hmm. I'm already doing it, so it is what it is.
That's the best way to live, though, because you're not projecting anything. It's like, I'm here now, and then whatever's going to happen is going to happen.
And then you always just sort of, it's always better and than you kind of thought. I mean, not always. Sometimes things suck, but usually you build things up to be worse in your head than it actually is, I would say most times. And then once you're doing it, you're like, well, all right, yeah. And that's what I think a child rearing is going to be. Yeah, all right, well, oh, yeah. Yeah, what, 18, 20 years of this? All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm a bit the opposite of you, right? I mean, I love what I do, but I love fun and I love my freedoms to do what it is I want to do. And my priorities are with my kids and my family, you know. Mm-hmm. I have sacrificed a lot of my career because I have prioritized something a little bit different, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's why I asked the question, meaning, you know, there are jobs that I haven't taken because I was going to be too far away from them. There are things that I have not done, movies I have not done, because I would rather go on a trip, okay, mm-hmm. with my
Titanic.
Family.
That was a bad Titanic. Decision.
Right.
Bad Titanic. Decision. You should have done Titanic.
Mm-hmm. This is us. This is us. I decided to go fishing instead of testing. And,
man.
You know, who knows if that would have actually worked out.
Mandy Moore is so much better than you would have been.
Yeah, I know. I know. I know.
Yeah, I think I did it. I mean, I hope I did it right. But I'm 37 years old now, and I waited around till now. I feel like I at least, you know, you never really have a true grip on this business because it's always changing. I think I heard someone say, I think it was Jim Gaffigan say, the entertainment business is just. You're constantly building a melting snow fort, and that snow fort is always melting. So you got to be making a new one constantly, and that's totally butchered. He said it much more eloquently than I just said, but it makes a lot of sense. And I've waited until I'm 37 now, and I think now I at least have some kind of handle on. A balance between my career and having a wife and kids. And I think even 5 years ago, if I would have just truly, crashed and burned. when it came to both things. But I think
you've done yourself a favor, and love is love, but you found somebody that understands the business and understands what it takes for you to be you, and you know what it takes to be successful, and you can have open, honest conversations about having kids eventually or what this marriage is going to look like, so that you know you can work together instead of constantly pulling at one another to be heard or to be understood with what it takes to succeed.
Yeah, I agree, Joe, and I hope that's exactly how it plays out. Chloe, listen to Joe.
Chloe, you get it. You get him. You understand the
you
business.
You get me, Chloe. You understand.
Is she there? No.
She's somewhere in the house. I'm not sure exactly. She's like, I thought he was doing the podcast.
Right. So your podcast, I think, is brilliantly titled. Mm-hmm. And the idea of it, explain the idea, because I think I get it, but it's a play on what is supposed to be the most important thing, but it's really ridiculous.
Well, it's sort of like how Workaholics was titled Workaholics, and we're three idiots who never do any work. And our podcast is called This Is Important. Get it wherever you get your podcast. And
yes.
It's basically everything is so important in now. Like, everything is so important. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. everyone thinks everything is so important because everyone has a platform to say what they think is important. So now mm-hmm. everything has become important. And we realize that nothing we say is actually important, but we might as well say this is important. Mm-hmm. And that is the podcast. It's just us being idiots talking about what we think is important, which isn't anything important.
Right. But which turns out to be important for a lot of people, probably.
Well, I mean, enough people like to listen to us, fart into a microphone for an hour. So,
hey,
please tune in.
it's important. It could be an important thing. You know, people farting into a microphone.
But you're right. I mean, we're in a new world where, with all these different platforms, I mean, people are putting their lunch up and, oh my God, this was amazing. And they've got filters on it. And it's, I mean, enough's enough. I don't know where the spiral ends. I don't think it ends well for any of us. But my God, for you, doing comedy and at times not thinking through everything that comes out of your mouth and the different ways it could upset or, I just, it's such a minefield now. It's got to be terrifying on one hand.
You know, it is, but also I think as a comedian, you always just have to be ready to kind of burn it all to the ground. And if you're not willing to say what's on your mind, and then what are you doing? I mean, then you're not a comedian.
But you have to be careful with that, obviously. Now, you can't just say what's on your mind anymore. That just
but
that
also,
doesn't
work. I feel what's on my mind is maybe you might be right. Cut to a week later, I'm just fully canceled after this comes out. He mentioned Bobby Lee's butthole one too many times. Yeah, he's done. Right.
But what I'm saying is that doesn't mean – when I say you can't say what's on your mind, I don't think that means that you have nefarious or evil or cancelable thoughts. It's just that you might have interpretations of things or philosophies about things or even just pontificating. You know, it doesn't necessarily talk about your heart, but you can't – really do those things much anymore. You have to censor yourself greatly.
Yeah, you have to have a real strong point of view. And actually,
unless you're Bill Burr.
Yeah, Bill Burr can say and do whatever he'd like. He's a damn genius. And also I feel like some people can, I feel like I have enough goodwill with people that they know that I'm not coming at anything, as you say, from a nefarious place, or mm-hmm. I mean anyone any real harm, and it all comes from a fun, good place. So that's sort of the leg that I'm standing on, and hopefully that doesn't come back to bite me.
What's kind of fucked up is it's not equitable, because if you have established yourself earlier on as a comedian or someone who is subversive or who is allowed to say those things, then you get a pass. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, take Howard Stern, who's like a god to me. Okay.
Sure.
Howard Stern, they tried maybe 5 months ago or whatever. They tried to do something where he was tried to cancel him. You can't touch him. He's Teflon, right? But if you go back in his career, or fuck back, go back 3 weeks. But if you go way back and listen to the types of things that he said and he did, it's insane. But you don't touch him. You can't touch him, right? But if you're a new person coming up, you know, you have to be careful.
Yeah, you can't be throwing bologna at naked women if you're a new person coming up in the radio game. You got to have a different spin.
That's right.
And
it's been done
before. No baloney. It's already been done.
No baloney. No. But if Adam Devine, go to the Braunschweiger. Braunschweiger packs a punch. Braunschweiger's got some girth. It's dense.
Or anal ring toss, too. There's anal ring toss.
Yeah, there was that back
well,
in the
that
day.
Seems fun. That seems fun.
Yeah.
That's more of visual element. That's...
I mean, who hasn't done that?
That's a YouTube video. You might have to check what your children are watching.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah. All right. So what's next? What's in the hopper for you? And then we'll let you go, Adam, because I know you're working on something. What's coming?
I got thank God, I've been out of work for a year now because of the pandemic and wasn't able to shoot my show. But I'm next week, I'm actually heading back to South Carolina to shoot The Righteous Gemstones on HBO. That I love doing, and I can't.
You're
wait
so
to get
good
back
in it, buddy,
there.
And your character is just fucking phenomenal. What a great
Thanks,
part!
Man.
To, what a great part it's, to play, huh?
It's so fun. I mean, I'm having a blast doing it, and I mean the cast is so damn funny. McBride is sort of on my Mount Rushmore of comics. He was one of the first, like a lot of other comics. They just seemed older, and they seemed out of my realm. Like they seem like gods, like the Will Ferrells, the Ben Stillers, the Sandlers, you know, the older than that, the Bill Murrays and things like that. I'm like, well, I'll never be them. Like I'm nothing like them. Those guys are kings. But then McBride was the first one that when I saw some of his earlier stuff, I was like, oh, I could do movies like that. Like that's sort of how I talk with my friends. So he was kind of immediately a more contemporary king of mine. And when he asked me to do the show, I kind of lost my mind.
Mm. Yeah, he's the man, dude. I love
Danny.
Really
is.
He's a good person, too, and just fucking hysterical and smart. And, he's great, dude. I love him.
And then John Goodman plays our dad.
Goodman, he's
a king.
He's from here. He's from St. Louis. So I've known John forever. He used to come down to Cardinal games all the time. And oh my God, the guy, he is, you talk about an accessible guy. Every time I'm around him, the way he is to everybody. I mean, you would not know, he has no air about him that is like, hey, I'm a star walking in. He's just kind of like there.
Yeah.
I love him.
He's the man. He truly is. And, he's just so funny and so giving in scenes and all that, you know, actory stuff. But he's truly a good dude. And our sister, Edie Patterson, who is so funny on the show, she was on Vice Principals, Danny's show before this one, and she's just a scene stealer. And, like, anytime I'm in a scene with her, I'm almost jealous of how many scenes she's stealing. I'm like, oh, I got to pick up the pace over here. She's running laps. And she's so damn funny, too. So I'm excited to get back to do that. And then after that, I got we're going to do a Workaholics movie. So that was just announced on Paramount Plus. And now we actually got to write this thing. So we have an idea as to what we're doing. And now we actually have to put the fingers to the keyboard and pound this baby out. So that's
now you're making Oliver feel bad again.
No, I think you need to go pen to paper on this one.
We're going old school. No one will be able to read it. Yeah.
Yeah. Just
treat it like a big journal.
Yeah. I'll go to parchment.
Yes. Perfect. Well, we've both been fans. I just I don't know. You steal enough scenes yourself, Adam.
Yes,
so,
you do.
So thank you for coming on. Thanks for being open, and good luck with everything. And say hi to Goodman for me.
Well, good luck with the wedding when it comes, and the future kids, man. Rooting for you. Love you, buddy.
Thanks so much,
Adam. Guys. Take care.
All right. See ya.
See ya. Thank you.
We have created a new segment, okay? I did. It's something called Guest Roulette.
Guest Roulette, Guest Roulette. You never believe who you're gonna get. Don't forget, it's Guest Roulette. It might be someone you never met. Guest Roulette, Guest Roulette. Guest Roulette.
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, 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 go. Dun. Just describe it. I'm playing the
okay.
Dun,
okay.
Dun,
okay. Dun. Go. So, Guest Roulette. Dun, dun, we have dun, many, many, many people waiting in our Zoom waiting room dun, right now. Dun. Joe and I will be calling upon a guest. Dun, dun. Well, they will be coming on the screen. We will have a quick conversation with them. It may last 5 minutes. It may last 10. These guests have not been pre-screened. Dun, 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 we have dun, no dun, idea who the fuck these people
wrap
are.
Wrap it up, Oliver.
Wrapping it up. Guest roulette. Guest roulette. Let's see what happens when we bring in our first guest. Margo, bring it on. Steven.
Yes, sir.
Steven, I'll give you $500,000 for your hair right now.
I had a feeling you'd say something like that.
Yeah, of course I would. I know.
We finally got some youth on the podcast, huh?
Yeah.
No, that's right, buddy. How old are you?
I am 20 years old. From Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Wow, we're big in the South. Evidently.
Well, you know, Joe. Obviously, the first thing Joe looks at is hair on every human being. You know,
I know.
And you know, for those of you who can't see, Steven's got some pretty sweet hair.
He's got
hair.
A great head of hair. He's got nice teeth. I mean, he's so far ahead of the game already.
Yeah, he's 20 years old listening to these old dudes, you know.
Oh,
talk
yeah.
Shit.
No, I knew I was kind of the minority in the age group. Yeah. Not many 20 year olds listening to you guys.
Are you going to school down there? Are you at LSU?
I am. I'm a junior in college at Nicholls State University.
Great. Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Nice.
Actually, I do PA announcing and play by play.
I was
going to
say
team.
Your voice is better than mine. So, and you're like in the best room. You've got serious bass going on there. That's a good room for you.
I'm in the library. Had to sneak into a study room. I didn't make a reservation, so I'm on guard.
Okay.
Oh, good. All right. Good.
I got a knock coming.
Okay. Great. Well, let's get to it then. So you don't.
How can we help you
today? Busted? What's your daddy issue?
I don't actually have any. I have a great relationship with my dad. He's 53. His name is Bill. One of my best friends. And he, he's just so supportive and just a really easy guy to talk to and hang around with. And he's, you know, I've talked about it before. He's the perfect combination of like stepping in and then just saying F it and kind of stepping away. Mm. I remember when I was a kindergartner, my brother was a first grader. And so first graders ride the bus. And I was at the bus stop with him. And, you know, everybody gets on the bus from the neighborhood and I'm looking at my dad, looking at the bus and he's like, go ahead. Yeah. I'm not, you know, you get up there, go figure it out, you know, and he's kind of done that my whole life and it's helped me, you know, kind of step out of my comfort.
Good for you and good for him. That's not easy to do as a parent. You'll see, and you'll have appreciation for that. And, you know, my dad did forever and is in the Hall of Fame doing what I do. And when I started at 19 in AAA and then 21 in the same booth next to him, he was never the guy that after the game was like, well, let me tell you how I would have called this or this is where you made a mistake. He just let me find my own way. And it's hard to do as a parent. I'm not good at it yet. But man, I'm so glad he did because I think I would have had resentment or something, you know, that would have pushed me away from him. And instead it drew me closer to him.
Sure. By the way, you know, I love that you have a great relationship with your dad, and it is called daddy issues, but the issue could be that there is a non-issue, you know, it's just, and I love that, man. And, Are you actually announcing? I mean, are you working? I mean, are you doing it for school, for your team?
No, I'm actually a criminal justice major. I'm going to LSU Law School after I graduate here. I know your former partner, Joe, went to law school.
Tim Green.
And so we'll see where it takes me. I really enjoy sports broadcasting, but we'll see, you know.
Well, I mean, if to have the desire to be a sports broadcaster, but you can fall back on like a law degree and, you know, the next Mitch McDear from The Firm. Great. Good for you. I already like you. So
I appreciate it.
I feel like we're doing America's Got Talent. So let's hear you call a triple into the left field corner. Go.
Yeah, no, I start baseball here shortly and never caught a baseball game. So we'll see how that goes.
Go ahead.
I'm just saying, look, as a performer, as an actor, or whatever the hell you want to call me, sometimes people are like, oh, be funny, do your thing. They put you on the spot. We obviously want to put you on the spot because of your voice and because of what you do. If you want to make a call of some kind, if you feel it in your bones right now that you could actually pull that off, don't want to put you on the spot, but the stage is yours to impress the Hall of Famer, Mr. Joe Buck.
I need you to lay down a scenario. Let's go. Where are we?
Runner,
Joe, put it out, if you Joe.
If you say you haven't done baseball, then what's your sport to this point?
I love basketball. Basketball, I mean.
All right. So the
one sport
New Orleans
Joe, like,
Pelican.
Know.
No, that's how I started doing basketball. When I was his age, when I was that kid's age right there, I was doing college basketball. So, but let's say the Pelicans are down by one with 8 seconds left on the clock. They've got the ball under their own basket, and, you know, they need a win to get into the playoffs.
All right. Let's say we're down one to the Spurs, okay?
Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah.
No timeouts left, 3 seconds left.
Okay.
Got it,
yeah.
Zion, Ingram, Ball, Bledsoe, and Redick, the five on the floor for the Pels.
Okay.
All right. And I'll be like Joe Myers.
Okay.
All right, so 3 seconds left. Pelicans down one here in the Smoothie King Center in New Orleans, Louisiana. Not a seat being used. Everybody on their feet. Ball, the inbounder. Full court pass to Redick. Three-pointer in the corner. Knocks it down. J.J. Redick wins the game for the New Orleans Pelicans. And, folks, this crowd is wild, and Joe Buck is happy, and Oliver Hutchins is happy.
That was awesome.
Yeah,
good job. Are you going to get kicked out of the library? That was awesome. Good job.
Yeah, no, that was probably it. I'll be getting the knock here shortly.
Right.
I have a quick story for you, Joe.
All right, go ahead.
Sorry, Oliver. I mean, I think you're awesome, but the announcement.
Don't worry, Joe. I'm better looking than him. It's fine.
No, yeah, you're right. And you got better hair.
Yeah, I got better hair. They got better hair.
And so, obviously, you know Brad Nessler, the SEC MC. Yeah, great voice. Love him. So he had a story. I was listening to a podcast. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it was, or don't quote me. I think it was Soldier Field. He was at a Bears game in like the mid 70s, and he and his dad were leaving, and he ran into Pat Summerall. And, you know, he was calling the game. Obviously, you know, Pat, you're his replacement.
Sure.
And young Brad Nessler, 10 or 11, little chubby kid, walks up to Pat. He goes, Pat, I'm going to take your job one day. And Pat goes, good luck, kid. And so that was that. And years later, when Brad, you know, becomes a well-known commentator and a personality, he sees Pat at a banquet or some preseason meeting or something. He goes, Pat, do you remember in the mid-70s a chubby 10 or 11-year-old boy coming up to you saying that he's going to take your job? Pat goes, that was you? Brad goes, yeah, that was me. Pat goes, you're getting closer.
That is so good.
Yeah.
It makes me think of my dad when people would say to little kids, like people your age, even younger, Mr. Buck, I want to be an announcer. What's your advice to somebody that wants to get into your profession and be an announcer for the Cardinals?
Yeah.
Start smoking. Which you don't need to say. I mean, you don't need to have a lower voice. Your voice is already lower than when I was doing Cardinals. You've got it.
I don't have a deep voice, but I mean, I embrace that. You know, I'm not gonna say it.
You got it. You already got the twinkle in your eye.
I was about to say Steven's got some shit. There's something.
Yeah.
He's got a little twinkle Keep well, it going,
I appreciate
brother.
That. I appreciate Keep that, guys. Going, man. Big, yeah. big fans of you too. Seriously.
Thank you. Thank you, brother. Thanks for checking in, Steve.
Thanks for checking in, man.
You can take my job. I'll remember
this.
Yeah.
Okay, watch out, Joe. I'm coming.
All right. Good.
You can All right, guys. All right. Thank you.
Later. Dude, Steven's a man.
I know. Stud.
I like Steven. Stud.
Yeah. I'd hire him right now.
Well, this was fun, man. This is really fun.
Yes. Love you, mean it. Bye.
Love you, mean it. Peace. Listen to Daddy Issues on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Daddy Issues is a production of Cavalry Audio and iHeartMedia, produced by Margot Carmichael.
Sound engineering and editing by Josh Windisch.
Executive produced by Joe Bach, Oliver Hudson, Dana Brunetti, and Keegan Rosenberger.